This is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. It's the 1980s in New York, a city in decay, nearly bankrupt and crumbling, with the AIDS epidemic looming just around the corner. David is the son of an abusive dad who grew up in Hell's Kitchen. He's a rebel in a punk band and into transgressive writers like Genet and Rimbaud. He earns money selling sex in Times Square. He expresses himself through murals and abandoned piers and stencil graffiti spray-painted on city sidewalks. He samples found images, photocopying and re-photographing them. But suddenly, he's at the epicenter of a new art movement in the East Village. His paintings appear at the Whitney Biennial, and people are even paying money for his art. Eventually, he becomes a central voice in both the art and gay rights movements before he dies in his 30s in 1992. Voyronovich is the name of a new documentary about the life and work of the artist, writer, and activist. The film incorporates voice recordings, film, video, and stills, as well as new interviews with his contemporaries. It follows the events of his life where art, culture, and sexuality and politics interacted. The doc is directed by award-winning filmmaker Chris McKim, known for his wide range of projects, from co-creator of RuPaul's Drag Race to the Emmy-winning documentary Out of Iraq. Voyronovich opens today at the Digital TIFF Bell Lightbox in Toronto, and I'm very pleased to have Chris McKim in L.A. here with me via Zoom to tell us more about Voyronovich. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So David Voyronovich was a central figure in the East Village art scene of the 1980s, but not everyone is familiar with his work. Could you describe some of the forms it takes?
David was a multimedia artist and originally wanted to be a poet, and really sort of in the art world got his start through photography. His work is a mix of photography and painting and collage and film, and all really sort of outlets for him to find expression and meaning in his life.
Toronto's been, I don't know what LA's like, but Toronto's been under a lockdown for a lot of the past year. But recently they opened up a few non-essential stores. And yesterday I was just in a random clothing store, and the first thing I saw were just tank tops with Keith Haring's images on them. So why aren't David's images on socks and underwear now? And what did this have to do with his attitude towards the commercialization of art?
Well, you know, David's work, which you can find on the occasional T-shirt, I think is not as readily identifiable as some of the Keith Haring stuff. And of course, in his lifetime, Keith Haring, you know, was marketing, you know, some of his images for clothing and whatnot. But David, you know, was kind of more of an anti-capitalist, and as Gracie Mansion says in the film, he didn't really like rich people. And so there was always, you know, I think a big struggle within him, which is common to a lot of people in the arts, of all sorts of, you know, people make their art and want to be recognized and seen, but then aren't necessarily in support of the people and the means of getting the work out there.
Yeah, and you just said he doesn't like rich people. In Manhattan in the 80s, the art scene coincided with the start of a real estate boom. So suddenly there were really rich people interacting with very poor, struggling artists. Can you tell us about that you show in the movie, one of these strange encounters David had with wealthy art collectors and gallerists?
In addition to not really liking rich people, you know, I think he had a problem, you know, he questioned art being made specifically for rich white people. And so there were a couple instances through art installations where David really kind of found a way to both share his art and his opinions of the scene. One being the Leo Castelli Gallery, where he and Julie Hare, who had been in the band Three Teens Kill Four with him, decided to dump cow bones and blood and some of David's stencils on the stairs.
Where did he get the cow bones?
Down in the meatpacking district on the street when they actually would be packing meat in that area instead of just, you know, clubs and restaurants and all the hot places in Manhattan. And then, of course, later in his life, you know, around 85, he did an installation for Robert Mnuchin, who, of course, went on to be father of, well, was father at the time, but of Steve Mnuchin, who was in the was Treasury Secretary in the Trump administration. And in that instance, David was putting in an installation in their basement, I guess their brownstone basement, and just made an incredible installation, as Carlo McCormick says in the film. But, you know, it was really just filled with trash and bugs. In some ways, that was, you know, David's little chance at joy in the midst of making this art in these folks' basement.
Yeah, a lot of his work seemed to involve found images and actually found objects. Why was the trashiness or the foundness important in his work?
Well, you know, I think someone says in the film, Alan Barrow says in the film, that, you know, a lot of these artists didn't have money for supplies. So in a lot of ways, the found objects were just a matter of utility. There were, you know, these things that could be painted on. And of course, you know, it took on deeper meaning as they use these materials. But I think initially it was really just a matter of accessibility. And, you know, for David, of course, he loved going out into nature and exploring. And so he'd find driftwood and bones and such, in addition to sort of like running around the city and taking trash can lids and, you know, old shopping, grocery store signs, and putting his own images over top of them.
So this is the 80s, and the AIDS epidemic was killing countless young people, but politicians at the period, like Ronald Reagan and even New York's Mayor Koch, they completely ignored it. They wouldn't even say the word. And this was also an era when there was a very strong right-wing movement. You could call it cancel culture if you want, that was shutting down exhibitions of queer art across the country. So David, in this time period, he found himself right in the middle of this controversy. What happened?
So David, Nan Golden was curating a show called Witnesses Against Our Vanishing, which was about the AIDS crisis, and incorporated her friends and reached out to, you know, artists that she knew to be involved with this project. And David, in addition to putting his images of Peter Hujar in the show, he wrote an essay for the catalog. And the essay, called Postcards from America, X-rays from Hell, sort of shared some of his personal feelings and observations of what was going on, and sort of calling out the politicians and Cardinal O'Connor for their, you know, sort of support of, or lack of support, both in terms of, you know, research and information and things that people could know to better protect themselves in the midst of the crisis. And so the FDA, which had, you know, granted a little bit of money to the show, got quite upset even before reading it, and then decided to pull their money, and it turned into this big thing, which, you know, we sort of cover in the film, in one of the opportunities where you actually get to sort of see David on screen in the moment, in a real sort of piece of verite as he's sort of dealing with the crisis, as it's unfolding, you know, doing interviews and watching reports on the news and really trying to like figure out what's going on. And of course, it's in a very different time. So in a pre-internet age, like, you know, the local evening news really is how these things are getting out there and, you know, the local newspapers. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see in the course of the film.
You mentioned Peter Hujar, and your film deals both with his art and his personal life. Hujar was his one-time lover, but also a very close mentor to him. And one of his most famous, which you mentioned, one of his most famous pieces of art are photographs of Peter dying. Can you talk about the conjunction of people dying of AIDS and the body of his art? In other words, how did he turn death into art?
Well, you know, in the instance of that particular case where, you know, after Peter died, which was Thanksgiving Day, 1987, there were a couple other people in the room at the time, David and Anita Vital, and a couple other people. And, you know, David kind of ushered them out of the room, and he took both film and photographs of Peter's body after he passed. And, you know, I think in that case, it's really bearing witness to, you know, what the AIDS crisis is doing to the population. And at that point, you know, many people didn't have firsthand accounts. And there were photographers and there were other, you know, people kind of putting these stories out there. But I think in that particular case, it's really, you know, the power of those particular images. You know, and of course, Peter was very important to him, as you said. And in fact, this very week, you know, there's a conversation in the film that David talks about, you know, he says, you know, last night I ran into Peter at a bar, and Peter really gave him advice about sort of his career and how to approach his art and how to feel about his own work and presenting it. And that conversation was exactly 40 years ago this week.
Wow.
Yeah, on David's tapes, which is really interesting, you know, just the way that it's easy. Sometimes it sounds so long ago, but the words are so immediate. And that journey that David takes is so relatable as somebody trying to like find his way in the world and through art, and then really use that art as a means of resistance as well.
Most of David's art was two-dimensional and still, but you made a moving documentary, a documentary that moves. How did you incorporate David's images, things like blood cells and jellyfish and swastikas? How did you take his images and put them into the editing and the body of the film itself?
Well, for me, one of the great things about David's work and his body of work and the way he used and developed his own sort of visual language was that he would reincorporate these ideas in all sorts of ways, whether it was the writing and the essays that would be worked into his collages or the backgrounds of his paintings or certain symbols like the sewn mouth and, you know, the various things he did. He did video art and performance art as well and some super 8 films. So the opportunity to use the material in a similar way and kind of appropriate David's own visual language to kind of illustrate his story made it a lot of fun and made it interesting. It really kind of opened up the world, because making the film, we really started with his audio. Everything was from the audio up.
You used hundreds of cassette recordings.
Yeah. There were almost 200 cassettes, which was a collection of his personal tape journals, which is most of, you know, how his presence is in the film, the way we hear him speaking. But in addition to that, you know, the answering machine tapes, which I thought, you know, I mean, there were dozens of those, and we spent hours, you know, listening to each one. And those, just as an experience of going through them, was interesting. But it really, like, to be able to bring people like Peter Hujar and David's sister Pat to life when that really is their only representation in the film was, you know, a real blessing.
Well, it's a beautiful film, and I really, really liked it. I'm so glad I saw it. Thanks so much for talking with me, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Chris McKim is the director of Voinarovich, opening today at the digital TIFF Bell Lightbox. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.